So I'm Rick Hansen. It's the 30th of July, 2014. And my general theme is fighting the good fight, right? In other words, I'm going to explore a series of topics about something that's rarely talked about in Buddhist circles, passion, assertiveness, and sticking it to the man, okay? Social justice and all the rest of that. So it's not a topic we normally tend to go into. And the angle on it tonight is I want to explore how we pursue wholesome values, wholesome goals, while having impact on others that they may not like, in ways that find that kind of middle way, where we're both doing what's honorable, pursuing our own dreams in lawful ways, without tipping into various pitfalls about our impact on other people. And so, as a bit of a frame, when I talk about fighting the good fight, first that was a phrase that someone here, there you are, great, brought up to me when we were talking earlier about dealing with sluggish bureaucracies and weird policies, often politically driven, coming downstream, entrenched opinion, things like that. And I was thinking about my own efforts to build this business. So when I talk about fighting a good fight, I'm talking about a lot of things. I'm talking about really struggling to get the toilet unplugged, right? I'm talking about really making sure that somebody else knows how you feel about something. I'm talking about hanging in there a tough 2 weeks or 1 week in college, in finals week, where you're just working hard to get to the end of this all. I'm talking about launching a business, pushing through the final stages of finishing your book under a deadline. Or in my case, you know, driving really hard to get this program launched and to get all the bugs out of the website, you know, by tomorrow midnight. That's fighting the good fight. How do we fight the good fight without tipping into greed, hatred, heartache, or delusion? How do we do that, particularly in terms of our impact on others? I just think this is a really cool topic, and if nothing else, it's really close to what's happening for me right now. Okay? Kind of get the territory, finding a good fight. So, impact. Speaking quite candidly, you know, and I'm being recorded, if you pursue a strong goal, very often it has impact on other people, right? For example, there you are, fill in the blank. You are really passionately involved in getting a stop sign put outside your kid's school. Or you're really engaged with getting to the end of your doctoral dissertation, right? Or you're a farmer and you've got to bring the crop in. My dad grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, and they had numerous situations where they had to get the hay in. They had to cut the grass, turn it into bales of hay and so forth, or their cattle would die over the winter and they'd be bankrupt come summer next year. They had to do it, and there were deadlines. My dad was taken out of school, three trimesters in a year. Every spring, he was taken out of school. So it took him longer to finish school and get on to college, but they were fighting a good fight. They had to get the harvest in. But when you do that sometimes, you're not available for other people, right? You have an impact on them. I'm really busy creating this all, and my wife is on, you know, the juice fast diet. She's on a Rick fast. She gets kind of small doses, you know, periodically, just enough to keep her alive. You know, not quite exactly, but there's an impact. We have impact. Right? Other impacts are sometimes when we pursue our goals, we compete with other people and we beat them. If you apply for a job, 100 people apply. If you get that job, that means that the next person in line didn't. Is that okay? How do we deal with that? Or what if you're in a situation, maybe a family system, and somebody is doing something that's harming other people? And it's important at some point, skillfully, hopefully, to talk about it or to address it in some way. And yet that would make that other person uncomfortable. They wouldn't like to have that talked about. Uncle Bob, you have a drinking problem, and nobody likes it when you come to Thanksgiving dinner, right? Or, you know, Jane, the daughter, you're just running a lot of attitude, and when you're upset about stuff, you're just kind of blowing everybody away. It's having a lot of impact here. That makes that other person uncomfortable. Do you see what I'm talking about? Impact. Our impact on other people. So how do we, you know, ethically and wisely explore the territory where to pursue our wholesome goals with wholesome means? Let's call that the good fight in a nutshell. Wholesome goals pursued with wholesome means. And yet sometimes it's going to have impacts on others that might increase their suffering. Right? That's the real world, isn't it? It's kind of easy to gloss over this issue, and I think it's important to sort of face it squarely. So I'm going to try to explore that with you, and we can talk about it. So I want to offer some kind of thought about it. First, I think there's some, well, I'll do it in this way, and then I'll see what you think, okay? So the first is, let's assume that there are wholesome goals and wholesome means. And that's an important place to start. Are my aims virtuous? Are they okay? Are they aligned with the greater good? Is there something lifting me and carrying me along that feels good and right and true? Some goal, some longing of the heart, some clarity about justice, some passion that needs to be expressed. You know, if you're a thoroughbred and you're strapped to a plow, maybe your good fight is unhitching yourself from that plow and honoring your own nature as a very creative, beautiful fast runner. Right? Okay, so first off, is it a wholesome end pursued with wholesome means? Sometimes we can have wholesome ends, but we tip into problematic means to those ends. Let's say that's true. And then let's look at our impact on others. When is our impact on others okay? We could say, and you could really should need to obviously see for yourself, and what characterizes not okay? Right? So one kind of impact on others is when we act unilaterally. That's very interesting. I think of a lot of people, myself at various times, like Gulliver, strapped down by 200 little threads, you know? Or someone in a spider's web. You're just kind of entangled, often through internal inhibitions against acting unilaterally, feeling like you need permission or agreement or consent, when actually you don't. You don't need their permission to think what you think or to, you know, in skillful, reasonable ways, share your experience, state your experience. Right? So that's one question right there. Do you give yourself the right? If you think about a sticky relationship where there's some sense of struggle, or a situation like a company or an organization, do you reserve to yourself at some deep level the right to act unilaterally? I think for a lot of people, they're pretty inhibited about that. And they seek agreement. Maybe they were raised in environments where if you acted unilaterally, you got smacked down. So people try to make sure they have permission and authority figures are supporting them. Okay, maybe there's a little bit of skillfulness around building coalitions, you know, laying the ground, helping other people understand what's happening here. But on the whole, you know, I think it's important to be able to reserve the right to act unilaterally. The Buddha sure did. You know, for better or worse, he reserved the right to act unilaterally in his own walking away from his household life as a young father, a young husband. He walked away. And he reserved to himself the right to be with his really kind of famous teachers at various stages who taught him everything they knew. He got to their level of realization. They wanted him to be their successor. And he reserved to himself the unilateral right to walk away, you know, in his own awakening. If you take it actually or merely metaphorically, when he was confronted with Mara, the representation of illusion, delusion, ignorance, and so forth, You know, he reserved the right to say, nope, these are not beautiful dancing girls. These are not scary demons. These are not piles and bags of gold. This is you, Mara. I see you. I reserve the right to see you. It's like the kid who sees the emperor with no clothes and says, I reserve the right unilaterally to declare my truth. So that's one right there. You know, I think there's a broad sphere in life where we really do have the right to act unilaterally. And will we claim to ourselves that power? And to generalize about gender, obviously a tricky business, but statistically it sure is true. Women are tend to be much more constrained around acting unilaterally than men, and are much more socialized around not acting unilaterally and punished for acting unilaterally. And there's a term from diversity work, internalized oppression. Internalized oppression. So it's important to explore the internalization. Whatever your cultural background is, or gendered socialization, or the particularities of your own family upbringing. You know, in my family, it was very scary to stand out, you know, to get your head above the weeds, because then you'd pop up on the radar, and then all kinds of bad stuff would start coming down on your head. So I learned to stay below the radar, and I've had to push myself to be willing to be free unilaterally to stick my head above the weeds. Okay. Second thing has to do with the rights that people have. Right? When do we have the right to act unilaterally or otherwise have an impact on others? And a major guideline for this really comes from ethical philosophy. And I'll try not to bore you to death, keep it super short, but it's actually really neat. Here's the one version of this fundamental principle from John Rawls' theory of justice. I mean, have some knowledge of that. He says, imagine a lottery, okay? And imagine 7 billion, you know, call them cards. So 7 billion cards are passed out, right? And you don't know what your card holds. And what your card holds is the rights that you and all others are allowed to have, right? So then the question is, what would you put on that card? What would you want to have on that card or hope was on that card, right? And it's kind of an interesting thing. In other words, if you're on the receiving end of someone's assertiveness or their good fight, right, it may be uncomfortable. But on the other hand, would you want to give up your right to be able to be in their shoes someday? See that idea? It's kind of a reversal. In other words, I think we would want a society in which people are allowed to pursue their wholesome ends with wholesome means, even if it makes other people uncomfortable. Even if it makes you uncomfortable, you would not want to withdraw that right from that other person, right? You'd say, no, I don't like it, but it's fair. I don't like it, but you're pursuing this job and you got it, okay? I would not want you to not have the right to apply. I would not want to have a society where people could not compete for a job or compete for a mate, you know, or compete in the marketplace of ideas or compete to have their book be successful or not. You know, we would not want to not allow competition or assertiveness of various kinds for others, right? Well, you flip it around, you say, well, you know, I'm having an impact on you, but I support the global fairness of a system that enables me to have that kind of impact on you, knowing that someone else may have that kind of impact on me tomorrow, and I'm willing to accept that ethically and honorably. It's kind of a weird way to think about it, but it's a good way to think about it. And suddenly we start realizing, wow, you know, there's a local problem, a local pain, my impact on this person, but the rights, the norms that we stand up for that enabled me to impact you in the way that was unpleasant for you, it had a loss for you, right? The system that allows me to impact you in that way creates a greater good for society as a whole. It's a way to think about it and a way to give yourself permission to maybe play in a little bit more rough and tumble way. It's kind of like football, you know. It doesn't feel good to be tackled and slammed hard to the ground, but that's the nature of the game, and I've got the right to tackle you on the next play, as it were. It goes both ways. Yeah. Yeah, you can be happy for them. Yeah.
And that can be challenging.
Yeah. So I just want to name that. Yeah.
What you just said reminded me of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so much was changing then. People like, I used to run past Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, but Malcolm X in New York City, or just a young secretary. Now, and many years before now, he was brilliant in really what he was talking about.
Yeah.
He was right.
Totally.
You know, and so was King, and so many people, new ideas were so frightening.
And they made others so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And yet we would recognize in retrospect even how important that was.
But, you know, what a wonderful thing, except, you know, the powers that be tend to eliminate people that have new ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's wise to recognize the pressures or forces that come against you. And sometimes I think, you know, the smart move is to lose this battle to fight another day, maybe. But if I could, I want to just name two more kind of keys around this issue of impact. So I've said first, can you reserve to yourself the right to act unilaterally, even without their permission or agreement? Or support, even, or liking it. Do they need to like your idea for you to stick up for your idea, et cetera? Second, you know, think about the golden rule, except reversed, right? If you would, you know, want to support a society that could allow, you know, yourself to be impacted in certain ways by others, well, flip it around. That might be a guideline for what's okay in terms of impacting others yourself. Okay. The third kind of thing I want to raise is the idea of speaking your own experience. Like sharing our own experience, even if it makes others uncomfortable. And I find a lot, yes, there's some people who just kind of dump their experience on other people willy-nilly. You know, they share their feelings, and then they go, what's the problem? You know, everybody else is like lying on the ground, you know, like a neutron bomb has gone off. All the buildings are preserved, but the living creatures are dead, you know, whatever. Like, okay. On the other hand, for that one person, personally, as a therapist and just a person kind of being around in the world, I think there are 19 other people who are inhibited around actually sharing their experience, their full experience with other people, unnecessarily inhibited. Because for them, it's really uncomfortable for other people to get uncomfortable with their experience. Last week I talked about risking the dreaded experience, right? Because that's a way to push through the invisible bars of our own cage. Can we tolerate other people being uncomfortable when we are really sharing our own experience? We're not blaming them for our experience. We're taking responsibility for our experience. But we're saying, I feel this, I think that, you know, what I saw was such and such with my own two eyes. What I need is this. What I long for is that. How it affects me when you do that thing is this. You know, and then the other person gets uncomfortable about it. Or they get twitchy, or they get angry about it. Can we tolerate their response to sharing our own experience? And I think often we need to be able to do that. You know? The question becomes, have I pursued a wholesome end with a wholesome aim? You know, the Buddha so emphasized intention. Is my intention ill will? You know? No. You're not trying to harm the other person. If you share your experience and they get their knickers in a twist about it and you shared it in a clean way and it's your experience, how much responsibility do you actually have for their reaction? I think pretty limited. You know, maybe there's some loose responsibility for your impact on them. But, you know, for me, I would really invite you to look into, you know, am I playing small unnecessarily or hunkering down unnecessarily, frankly, because when other people get uncomfortable, I get uncomfortable. And so I muzzle myself. And then the last one, and then I'll see what you think about it, just to offer it again, is holding people to their agreements. In other words, so I'm exploring with you here what I consider as some sort of guidelines for the ethical pursuit of our own aims, even though it has impacts on others. You know, the right to act unilaterally, a recognition of what's fair in terms of the golden rule reversed. Third, you know, sharing our experience and not feeling that we're to blame for the reactions of others. And then last, holding people to their agreements, real agreements. Agreements, including implicit agreements. Wow, you said you'd pick me up on time. Yeah, you said you wouldn't get high anymore. Oh, you said that you would send me that money. You said that you would fix that thing in my computer, on my website. I'm dealing right now with a big snafu on the IT side with people that should have fixed things months ago. And in this drive to launching and going live, we are surfacing so many. You know how you turn over stones? Well, that's really true in the website world. You know, you turn over the stone and go, oy, what's under that? You know? You're like, whoa, I thought somebody had handled that one already. Oy, oy. So how do you hold people to their agreements? How do you go back to the email? How do you go back to the kid? The kid said, you know, I would mow the lawn. Or how do you talk about that with people? And I think that's also really important, to find a way to, you know, hold people to an agreement. Because if you don't, it becomes the new normal. Let's say your partner says, and this is a common situation, you know, when I was, you know, involved in, well, I've seen this a lot in couples counseling. You have a situation where one parent is more of a stay-at-home parent, you know, handling the kids. One parent is more going out in the world working. Often it's mom, dad, not always. Sometimes it's reversed. In any case, the person who's out in the world basically makes promises about coming home at a certain time for dinner, participating with the family, helping, being involved, et cetera, right? So they say, I'll be home. Okay, I'll be home at 6 o'clock. And then they actually get home at 6:15 or 6:30, and they don't say a word, right? So it was a real conversation, promise, and then the next day they come home half an hour late, and they don't say a word. What do you do? If you don't say a word, oh, okay, it becomes a new normal. All right, I guess it's fine to come home at 6:30. Or more broadly, it's fine to break my agreements with you. I better keep them with the folks at work, like that matters a lot. But the person I'm, you know, bonded with, that I'm raising children with, yeah, I can break my agreements with you. There are no consequences, there's no justice, there's no calling to account. Sure, why not? You know, there's no disincentive. Like, why not? See what I mean? So I think there's really a place for I'll just call it ethical impacts, all right, for holding people to agreements. We have to be careful how we do that. There are a lot of pitfalls around, you know, holding people to agreements, getting righteous. It's important to watch tone, make sure that there was a genuine agreement. Sometimes we think they agreed, but they don't think they agreed. Or we think they agreed to X, but they think they agreed to Y or Z, and there's some fuzz in the middle. So I think it's smart. I've saved myself a lot of grief in some of my emails when I'm kind of calling people to account, but I do it in a very kind of understated way because I say up front, I might be wrong about this, but, and you know what? I was wrong about it. I'd never said that, or I never actually sent them that email, or they actually never said they would deliver by May. It was June or something, you know what I mean? But calling people to their agreements, you know. Okay, good. All right. What do you think about that? You can tell I'm kind of fired up because I'm fighting the good fight.
Yeah. Since I suggested the topic,
it's all your fault.
I'm blank, and I just want to give a little background. So the United States Supreme Court held Jerry Brown prison system in the state of California, and it was all about medical care, essentially. It wasn't so much about over. So Jerry, in his Jesuitical casuistry, I voted for him.
You're going to do this in a summary way. For me to continue to fight the good fight, I've got to leave on time tonight.
Right.
Okay.
Quick. So the county came to my...
Actually, I got to interrupt you. I'm going to do it. Let me interrupt you for a second, okay?
Okay.
Ready? I had an impact on him, didn't I? Right there.
Right.
So I'm making it live to make it real. Plus, I'm a therapist, so I go live all the time. But anyway, I had an impact on you.
Yes.
Right? You watched me all do that, didn't I? Mm-hmm. You know, let's be condensed. I've got to leave on time tonight, et cetera. Was that okay for me to do? You see? Well, and maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. And did I do it in an okay way? But the point is, we have lots of impacts on other people where we express our needs and stuff like that. And then the question is, live right here. Wholesome means yes or no. And then how does the other person handle it, like you handle it very gracefully there, still are, when we have impact on them? Yeah? Isn't that interesting? Right there. So you think about that. Okay.
We're trying to help prisoners. That's what we're trying to do. Getting out with their addiction. Okay, the county wants to give us like $10 a prisoner to treat them. I'm exaggerating. I always do that. They're giving us 3 1.5 hours and a single hour of therapy. Well, first you got to treat them for PTSD. I don't want to go into it. But the thing is that it's the good fight. We're trying to fight. And you suggested Insight Prison Project. And why didn't I think of that in the first place? Because you're so smart. And
I'm not involved with it. It's easy, you know, for the outsider.
That's the good fight. And then I get in my, did you see me get on my soapbox? Did you hear that? You know, and that's my default mode. And then I get adversarial. And then I get advocacy. And then I don't see your side, and I'm mad. And
those are the pitfalls around impacts.
And then I start ranting, which I start, you know, going to the Supreme Court and blah, blah, blah. And it's really tough because it hits the emotional issue. And you get the self-righteous indignation, they're wrong, I'm right.
Yeah, thank you for everything in that, including your own passion. You know, I think sometimes maybe to kind of finish on this point, there can be a certain taboo in more of the mindfulness world or the therapy world or the, you know, Buddhist world, a taboo against passion. Mm-hmm. You know, for getting fiery, for getting heated, or for being, you know, acting in ways that make others uncomfortable. Right? And the way I personally think about this is like I'm driving under a caution flag. There's a yellow flag. But I'm still going fast. I'm still doing my thing. Because when we get revved up, when we're fighting the good fight, it's very easy to tip over to the dark side of the force, as it were. So we really need to be particularly mindful if we're going to fight the good fight or if we're willing to have ethical impacts on other people. But that said, you know, can you let yourself go full speed under a caution flag? Okay, let's sit for a minute and wrap it up. And then I'll have to leave fairly briskly because I have more fights to fight tonight. Thank you so much. I really mean that. I have like super thanks for you.
Did you tell me to remind you to talk to Donna about being a steward? And she's here, and I actually said to her that you might want to talk
where's
to her.
She?
She's right there putting...
Restrict our distribution because the email address, whoops.